Well, hi folks, welcome back to Naturally Adventurous. This is this week Ken and Charlie, and we're joined by good friend of the podcast, almost honorary third host, Julian. Let's see if I can say his last name correctly. Hoff.
Well done, Mr. Barons.
I think that it's like the fourth time we've chatted on the podcast, so you know, getting there slowly.
Yeah.
Working on my Yorkshire accent.
Especially since I'm from Lancashire. Mm.
Well, pretty close.
Well, you were doing so good. He was doing so good with the name, and then he just spoilt it by accusing me of being a Yorkshireman.
So, Julian was recently, I guess a few weeks ago, in Senegal. This is a West African country neither Charlie nor I has been to yet. It definitely holds some of the coolest African birds that I haven't yet seen. So this is going to be a pretty gripping podcast for both Charlie and I. Yeah, well, I'm just eager to learn a bit more about Senegal. Yeah, kind of fascinating country. It seems very culturally vibrant. I've flown through Dakar a few times. You know, South African, coming from the States, they always used to stop in Dakar. So I have a little bit of a feeling for
refueling.
Dakar.
Refueling.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've done that. Yeah.
But yeah, I haven't been in the bush at all. So yeah, I guess we'll just get straight into it, Julian. And my first question is just, you know, how did you choose Senegal?
Well, it started last year when we were planning a trip. Nick Bonomo, who you've had on the podcast, and my other good friend, Dave Preventure. We've done a lot of trips together. And I'd started to plan a trip to Israel for this March to do some, you know, migration. But obviously with what's going on over there, that quickly became not an option. So in January, Nick suggested Senegal. A couple of our good friends had been to Senegal. And it made sense because when you look at it, it's less than an 8-hour flight from New York. And it has a great mix of African wintering, great mix of African and wintering Palearctic migrants. And as you hinted at, Ken, it's got some hard to see enigmatic species there that are pretty gripping. So get ready to be gripped off. You know, stuff like golden nightjar, quail plover, are really some of the top targets for anybody visiting Senegal. So really, it made sense. And at the last minute, when Nick had suggested it in January, we decided to go full dude on this trip and hire a driver and a guide because the logistics and the time that we had to put a trip together ourselves independently was just not going to happen. So kudos and a big thanks to Nick. He basically got all the logistics and reached out to the tour company over there that we were going to use. And he kind of put most of the ground stuff together. So that saved us a lot of hassle. So it turned out to be a pretty easy trip. Normally, we're not the clients, but on this trip, it was nice to be able to just relax on some of the longer drives. So basically, that was it. It was just an easy-to-get-to place.
I believe getting there was a bit of a... just the pre-tour was a bit of a traumatic experience, was it?
Yeah. As I think, you know, we'd spoken about privately, I'll set this up for the listeners. So what had happened is I was going to plan a trip early in the year because my mum's health had been going downhill for the past couple of years. So I was anticipating needing to be available for the rest of the year. So when this trip came up in February, I thought, well, it'll get it out of the way early so that if I need to be available for family stuff, I would. However, 2 weeks before the trip, unfortunately, we got an end-of-life diagnosis for my mom, who'd not been well. And it went south pretty quickly, and she passed away, unfortunately, a few days after we'd finalized the whole trip. So I had to basically drop everything and fly to England to, you know, deal with funeral plans and help support my sister, who'd been doing a huge amount of work in England, obviously, because I couldn't be there. So, you know, I was thinking, well, how long is it going to take? You know, I didn't want to let the guys down, obviously, since we booked the trip. And I was looking at flying to Dakar from England, if that was an option. But it was like 20 hours to get there. There's no real easy way to get there. So and managed to take care of everything over there, flew back. And 4 days, I think, before I was due to fly out, I started to get some really bad chest pains and ended up in the ER with a gallstone diagnosis, which was not what I was expecting a few days before a huge birding trip. So I said to the doctor, because my sister had just had gallbladder surgery like a month before, and I'd seen her go through some horrible pains here. And the doctor said, just go on your trip and, you know, just get medical insurance. So obviously, I always get medical insurance. But what happened 2 days before is I realized at that point I had a pre-existing medical condition and I couldn't get travel insurance. So I spent 5 hours on the phone, and I was on the verge of canceling the trip the night before. I'd spoken to the guys and said, look, I hate to do this, but there's a chance that if I don't have medical coverage and something happens to me there and I don't get covered, I could be bankrupt. It didn't make much sense to do that. So,
yeah.
You know, I don't know if you've come across that, but what happened, just to tie up the stories, I spoke to the guide in Senegal. I was able to wire money back and forward to Africa that night to kind of meet the exclusion of one particular policy, and I was able to go. But it was not a fun day before a trip of dealing with that. And I was fine on the trip, but it was something that going forward, yeah, if you've got any medical issues, get medical insurance when you book your trip, not 2 days before. So, yeah, that was a bit of a stressful start to the trip.
Yeah. So how does that work? Like, if you have been diagnosed by a medical professional with something, your travel insurance is not going to cover that? I'm asking myself, how does that work? Because people often have, like, intermittent heart problems, and they manage to get travel insurance.
Yeah, so I'll, for your listeners and anybody traveling, I'll be able to give you the first-hand explanation
yes.
of that.
Yes, from the trenches.
What usually happens is you can travel with pre-existing medical conditions. Usually what the exclusion is if you've booked a trip, let's say you've booked the flight. Once you've booked the flight, there's like a time window that starts ticking. So if you buy a policy within 14 days of your first payment, that's usually the flight, you're fine, you're covered. Not a problem. The problem for me, I'm pretty healthy, and normally my credit card covers all my trip cancellation. So normally I just buy a small policy to cover medical evacuation, which makes sense. But unfortunately, I ended up in the hospital only a couple of days before I was flying. So I was already outside that 14-day window,
right,
and wasn't covered. Nobody will insure you a couple of days before you fly. That was what happened after calling like 6 or 7 insurance companies that day. But one company I found that if you had bought a policy and made a last payment, not a first payment, made your last payment within 24 hours of buying the policy, you were covered. So I was able to make that payment after I got the policy and I was able to go. But other than that, I would have had to cancel the trip. So really, if you do travel, it makes sense, if you're going to get medical insurance, get it when you book your flight so that you don't put yourself outside of that window. So
right.
That was a big learning experience for me. Huh. But it all worked out, but it was a bit stressful.
I tell you, it's worth getting that medical evacuation. I've had twice on tours that I've led, I've had people that have had to be medically evacuated. And I mean, the cost of that is, it goes to hundreds of thousands of dollars to be evacuated back to, especially back to the US. So yeah, it's definitely something worth getting.
Yeah, agreed. Well, that was the main thing. And, you know, at that point, I was going to risk getting a flare-up while I was there with medical insurance. But there's no way I could go. And the guys were great about it. They said, look, you know, if anything happens, we'll take care of everybody. The burden will come second. So that put me at ease. And I was fine, but it was a bit of a wake-up call as far as getting a medical diagnosis like that. That had they said, look, if you get a gallstone, because you can't pass them like a kidney stone. If it gets stuck and infected, you need surgery right away. So, it wasn't just a small thing.
I wonder what the medical care in Senegal is like. I mean, doesn't strike me as a very developed country, but I'm sure they have some good hospitals there.
I wasn't going to find out, Charlie.
You might have had to use your sort of GCSE French trip to the doctor stuff.
It was going to be jumping on a flight back.
J'ai mal à la tête.
Le problème est ici. Non, non, pas là. Ici. Non, non, coupe pas là.
Problème, docteur. Oh. Où est le médecin?
Yeah, I'd have died before I'd figured out how to say that. But anyway, so that was the most miserable start to the trip. You know, you want a nice, easy start to the trip, and that wasn't fun. So,
but you made it.
Made it. It was fine. Had a brilliant trip. Yeah, it was wonderful. And I'll be happy to share some of the stories with you. And I just ask away.
Well, I'm curious about the overall plan of the trip. I know Senegal has quite a high diversity of different habitats. As you know, we're definitely into this habitat stuff. In Senegal, you really get everything from like full-on semi-desert Sahel to dry thorn savanna to moist mix savanna to Guinea savanna and even to some rainforest type stuff, right? So I imagine you covered quite a bit of ground.
Yeah, so as you said, so, you know, Senegal being the westernmost country in Africa, it's bordered by Mauritania in the north and those Guinea areas to the south, and quite a dry, arid Sahel landscape. You know, that Sahel zone is that northern region of Senegal that extends east to west by thousands of kilometers, and it's just made up of these dry savanna, thorn scrub acacia areas. And then in the south of Senegal, it can be quite tropical in areas like, you know, Ouassadou in the southeast where we went. It's a lot lusher because of the riverine systems that are set up there. But pretty uninspiring from a picturesque point of view, you know, just very hot during the day. You know, it got up to probably 100 degrees every day and slightly cooler mornings and evenings. So we did a lot of the traveling in the afternoon, like most places.
Can I ask you where the closest place to Senegal that you'd been to is? Like, where in Africa had you been to before?
So, West Africa was my last compass point. So I did South Africa, as you know, on the podcast. And the closest that I'd been was Morocco. So that kind of did the North African point of view. So that's the closest to Senegal that I'd been. And there's a few birds there that overlap.
Very few.
The recently split Atlas wheatear, used to be called Seabum's wheatear, and Fulvus babbler, or I think it's Fulvus chatterer now, as it's been renamed, are a couple of things that I didn't see in Senegal. We didn't see Fulvus chatter in Senegal, but I'd seen that in Morocco, I believe. So there was a few things that overlapped, but between Morocco and Senegal, you have, you know, Mauritania, and you have that independent Western Sahara region, which kind of is a bit of a buffer zone there between what's still classed the Western Palearctic, right?
Right. It's fundamentally a different continent from a biogeographic perspective. You know, the North Africa is really aligned with the Mediterranean and Europe, and everything south of the Sahara is, you know, people often call it sub-Saharan Africa. So, yeah, I mean, Morocco doesn't share that many more birds with Senegal than, say, Iraq would, right? It's just a whole different zone, or Turkey, or...
What was surprising to me as I delved into Senegal, you know, it wasn't really on my radar until Nick suggested it. But I was very interested in seeing a few Palearctic migrants that I hadn't seen. I'd spent a lot of time in Central America recently, in Colombia, and I really wanted to get back, see a few, you know, Philosks You know, sick and tired of seeing all these bright American things. I really want to see some really dull warblers, you know.
Yeah, proper warblers, and, yeah.
Yeah, so the amount of wintering Palearctic migrants in Senegal, though, especially in the north around Juge National Park, it's a highly rich ecosystem. It's just filled with birds. I mean, there's a couple of UNESCO-listed sites there, the Saloum Delta and the wetlands around Juge, and, you know, UNESCO listed is just basically a global site that's significant from a cultural, natural history point of view. And in the north, and we can get into it, but we saw so many birds there in one day than I think I've ever seen in any one place ever. It was just staggering.
Wow, wow. That's serious.
Yeah, it was crazy. And, you know, we can talk about that probably later if we do a site by site, but yeah, just a really birdy, easy to get around. You know, you're not in a rainforest looking for skulking song wrens and ant pitters. You know, everything's pretty easy to see and visible. Some take a bit of searching for, but birding's pretty easy. It was a really nice experience.
You mentioned some of the warblers there, like Philoscopus and things that you hadn't seen. A lot of these Palearctic warblers have been kind of split like east and west, so there's a lot of kind of western Orphean and western subalpine and western Benelli's and all these kind of things, so I'm actually missing a lot of those things as well. But I kind of think a lot of those things is like sort of Spanish and western Europe, like kind of come down to that side.
Yeah, definitely if you've birded in Southern Europe, Spain, or France, these are the species that you will have seen there. So, you know, everything's Western Benelli's warbler. The interesting Philosc there that people need to kind of pay attention to is, since they've split Iberian and common chiffchaff, both of which winter in Senegal, it can be tough, especially if birds are not calling. So we had a couple of chiffchaffs that I wasn't sure about. And to be honest, like when you've got Abyssinian rollers flying around,
I was going to say
everything like that, I'm not spending a lot of time looking at Philosks. It's like, oh, okay, there's a chiffchaff, time to move on. So yeah, I would like to have spent a bit more time looking at those, but there really wasn't any point, especially when you got so much other good stuff to look at.
Doesn't British birding almost program you with some feeling of like borderline moral obligation to like study these things and become more proficient in their identification, even if it's a totally pleasureless activity?
You know, I couldn't have said it. I couldn't have put it into any better words, Ken. That's perfect. Yeah, I'll not be doing my countrymen any honor if I don't spend time looking at this. You know, it was like sticking a fork in your eye, to be honest. It's like, oh, it's like,
I'm going to stop looking at this carmine bee eater and study this.
Yeah, no.
Chiffchaff, worn chiffchaff, a little bit more.
I think at one point it was just to get Iberian on the trip list. You know, I think we were getting up to like 299 species for the trip, and you start trying to add whatever you can to get the list up. And I think Nick needed Iberian chiffchaff, so I was working hard to get them a tick. But yeah, they didn't care either. They're like, oh, okay, yeah, all right, we'll move on.
I would have been looking.
Well, the other thing that we talked about always on trips is food. And I was thinking of you, Charlie, because as a fussy eater myself, being a vegetarian, Nick and Dave are pretty easy. They'll eat anything. But whenever I go, it's like, you know, I have to figure out how to eat vegetarian. And I'm vegetarian, not really for moral reasons. I've just never eaten meat. So I just want to let you know, if you go to Senegal, you're pretty screwed as a vegetarian. You'll be eating a lot of rice.
I was just saying legume. That's Charlie's. He always rants about that in Madagascar. They think vegetarian means eats vegetables.
Eats vegetables, yeah.
Well, the vegetarian option typically was the same meal that Nick and Dave had, except they just took the meat off my plate.
Totally protein-free.
It wasn't bad. There were some really good fried rice dishes we had. And Ismaila, the guide, always went out of his way to kind of hook me up with some vegetarian stuff. So there's a lot of omelets, a lot of chips or French fries, and a couple of places we stayed at. We had some really nice meals, some good soups, some nice pasta. But generally speaking, the joke for the meat eaters was the choice every night was chicken or fish. So even they didn't get a lot of variety. But generally speaking, the food was pretty tasty, if not varied. But yeah, it's not a place to go if you're vegan or vegetarian. But you can make it work. You certainly won't be putting any weight on.
So in Ghana, you know, way down the coast in West Africa, it's actually pretty good food. You know, classic Ghanaian West African thing is fufu, and they have things like rice balls. Do those types of things, like big balls of starch in savory soups, do those make it up to Senegal?
Yeah, so a couple of the nicer places we stayed, we got some nice lentil and butternut squash soups. But generally speaking, if we were stopping on the road or eating in the restaurant of the hotel, typically it would be, for Nick and Dave, it would be a choice of some local sourced fish. Chicken, it seems, is like the main staple there. And then that usually comes with a side of either rice or vegetables or chips. So that was kind of it. But it wasn't very varied on the road.
That sort of sounds like generic Western tourist type cuisine. Did you have a sense of the locals eating a similar diet? Or do you think there's different stuff that Senegalese eat?
No, I think it was pretty much the same. One of the things I laughed at some of the roadside cafes that we stopped at, they have all these printed placemats that are basically the menu printed. And it's full of like amazing looking sandwiches and crepes and omelets. Yep. And then you go to ask for one of those and they were like, chicken or fish, sir.
Chicken or fish.
So it's like, oh, so that was, we had a good laugh about that. But no, it was good. And then obviously the culture of Senegal too is, as you hinted at, you know, it's mainly French speaking. I think they gained independence from France in 1960. And it's a fairly stable place. It's predominantly Muslim. And I think there's about 18 million people living in Senegal. And, you know, it was not too crowded, but the roads were definitely of decent standard there traveling around. And, you know, there wasn't any major hassles driving to and from places. So it wasn't as crazy as, say, traveling in India. But some of the big towns, just a lot of horses and carts of people getting around. That's one thing I did notice driving around, is there wasn't a huge amount of vehicles, a lot of trucks. But most people going to market just had horse and carts. It was cool. It was a nice experience to see kind of part of Senegal.
Do you see any other tourists going around? Like regular tourists, or is it, were you there?
No, so.
In the minority there? Not really.
Pretty much the minority. So we'd engaged the services of a local company there that was pretty highly respected. Now, I know Tropical Birding has tours to Senegal, but as a couple of independent people, we managed to get hold of a guy there who basically couldn't lead us himself, but hooked us up with a guide and a driver. And our driver, Modu, just a really, really great guy. Safe driver, just totally chill. And our guide was great. But driving around, we didn't bump into many other tourists. We bumped into a couple of Swedish birders at a place called Wasadu. But other than that, we just birded ourselves and didn't really bump into anybody else.
I'm curious, this is maybe more for my own edification than anything else, but I'm curious how expensive it was to set up this tour. You know, it's not the typical way you do things. You were sort of looked after by a driver and a guide. Africa is pretty expensive in general. There's often not very good, cheap ways to visit many African countries.
Yeah, I have no real cost comparison. My friends had just been to the Gambia. So for anybody listening, you know, Senegal basically encompasses the Gambia region.
Literally encompasses.
Literally, yeah. It's like, you know, it's you can cross the border into northern Senegal, but crossing from the Gambia into southern Senegal, it can be pretty risky and dangerous down there due to some political unrest, I think, or civil unrest. So basically, they'd been to a couple of places in Senegal where they crossed over the border to get a few birds like, you know, Egyptian plover and a few other species. But their cost of their trip was very similar to the cost of our trip to Senegal. But to not have to deal with the driving, we could have hired a driver and not a guide, but the difference in cost when Nick priced it out, it didn't make any sense to not have a guide too, especially since we were pretty much not as prepared as we normally are on a trip. So it was kind of nice just to relax. There were a couple of long drives between sites, so to be able to just relax in the van and not have to worry right. about which river I'm going to have to move rocks out of the way to cross, you know? it's like they knew exactly where to go. So it was a really relaxing trip. And, you know, obviously you just pay for the convenience of that. So, yeah, it wasn't cheap because, as Charlie would like to say, you know, he's frugal and so am I. We could have done it way cheaper, but it would have been a lot more stressful given the logistics. But it's definitely affordable.
It strikes me that there's a couple of birds that you were looking for that you might have struggled. I mean, there must have been some real kind of local knowledge with a guide, you know, for like the nightjar or the quail plover or whatever, you know, that they actually know like a good spot for those.
Yeah.
Just wandering around kind of cluelessly. Yeah?
Given the time frame. So essentially, a lot of the tours and people that do this trip usually spend about 15 days birding the areas we went to. So essentially, a lot of the sites are in the north of Senegal, north of Dakar. And there's a couple of sites that are really good in the southeast. And this is where there is a couple of long drives on this Senegal trip. We basically follow the same route as most trip reports. And Ouassadou is a place on the Gambia River in the southeast, which is about a five-hour drive to get there and a five-hour drive back to the main sites. And we contemplated in the time that we had, do we want to do... It's a couple of days out of our itinerary. And when we looked at what the species were on offer there, and we'd spoken to another British guy, Oscar Campbell, and he said, you'd be crazy not to go to Ouassadou if you're going. So that kind of made our mind up for us. So Ouassadou was the site that we were going to see Egyptian plover, which was a huge target bird for me. It's kind of that iconic Gambia, Senegal species. So we're like, yeah, let's just do it. You know, we don't have to do the driving. We'll just sleep in the car. The other stuff that you talked about, there's a white-crested tiger heron and quail plover, again, another enigmatic species that is hard to find if you don't know the area. So having a guide, right. as you say, for those things just made yeah. sense. A couple of species, you know, if we're going to get into this, like, top five rubbish, if we're going to go down
rubbish.
That route. No, it was funny. I was thinking they're going to ask me what the best birds of the trip were. there was so many. I think we saw between us 300 species in 11 days, and that included like 40 species of raptor, like 7 species of wow. beater, just really birdie. And I think, you know, obviously some of the grippers that are coming your way. I know, Ken, quail plover was a huge kind of mouth-watering bird that you haven't seen, that is kind of, It's just so strange.
Yeah, unique bird. And you did a little video trip report that was quite sweet, and you had this little quail plover doing this little dance and kind of matched up to the music, and that was especially gripping.
Yeah, quail plover, for obviously a lot of people that won't know what this is, it's a really strange, unique bird that lives in this dry acacia scrub in this like micro habitat, and it's actually a button quail or a hemipode, and it's the only species in its genus, but it does look like a quail had sex with an American woodcock or a jackson. You know, it just does this really weird bobbing dance, and we managed to see quite a number. I think we've maybe had 3 or 4 sightings of this bird, and then finally we got one that didn't flush, and the video that I took, you know, Nick was able to get some really nice video of it doing its kind of American woodcock like bob, but that was a really good bird to get. I mean, some people can struggle with that. I mean, they can spend hours just traipsing around this kind of dry acacia scrub in the heat of the day for hours, and it can be pretty brutal. But we managed to get there in the afternoon, and I think we'd seen 3 in about the first half an hour, so it was really good. Again, the guide knew exactly which area to go to, so it made it easy.
I would have assumed that you would have been just flushing them, you know, and just getting brief flight views, but I was impressed that you were able to get views on the deck.
Oh, we're professional, Charlie.
Yeah,
we don't mess around. We don't mess around, you know. No, well, that's exactly what we did. We flushed a couple, and then once we'd figured out where they were,
chased them.
We employed amazing field craft to just try and not flush the ones that we knew were kind of hunkered down. Once you flush them, they kind of just sit there. So we were able to just find one that was hunkered down for a while, and then, you know, we just sat there and waited for it to do its stuff. And, you know, they're pretty approachable once you know where they are, and you can kind of take a slow approach. But yeah, like a lot of things, the first views were of them in flight. You know, they're tiny little things.
It seems quite a different behavior from button quail. I mean, I was chasing button quails just the other day, and we would flush them, and you know, they'll fly a short distance, land, but as I always find, as soon as they hit the deck, they just start running.
Yep.
So the longer it takes you to get to where they landed, the further they're going to be away. So you're almost like charging towards where it landed, just to sort of get another flight view. Otherwise, you know, you might not flush it again. So it's But you're saying they sort of land and freeze, or what?
Yeah, they fly a short distance and then they just kind of sit still and don't do a lot of running around. They were quite docile, to be honest, once we knew where they were and we didn't flush them. But obviously, the colour of these blends in so well with the acacia and sand that it just seeing them on the ground before you flush one is really difficult.
As often happens with Julian's podcast, we've gone a little bit over time and decided to split this episode up into 2 parts. We're going to play out with the amazing quail plover. I just checked online, and there's only 1 recording of quail plover, and that was taken just over a month ago. This historical recording was taken by Javier Train Garcia, so many congratulations for that. The audio was lifted from a video that he took, and I'll put the link for that video in the episode description, so check it out. Thanks again to Julian for all his wonderful stories, and we'll see you all again next week on Naturally Adventurous.